Dilsey said she was in the house. I went on into the hall and listened, but I didn't hear anything. I went upstairs, but just as I passed her door, she called me. "I just wanted to know who it was," she says. "I'm here alone so much that I hear every sound." "You don't have to stay here," I says. "You could spend the whole day visiting like other women if you wanted to." She came to the door. "I thought maybe you were sick," she says, "having to hurry through your dinner like you did." "Better luck next time," I says. "What do you want?" "Is anything wrong?" she says. "What could be?" I says. "Can't I come home in the middle of the afternoon without upsetting the whole house?" "Have you seen Quentin?" she says. "She's in school," I says. "It's after 3, she says. "I heard the clock strike at least a half an hour ago. She ought to be home by now." "Ought she?" I says. "When have you ever seen her before dark?" "She ought to be home," she says. "When I was a girl, you had somebody to make you behave yourself," I says. "She hasn't." "I can't do anything with her," she says. "I've tried and I've tried." "And you won't let me for some reason," I says, "so you ought to be satisfied." I went on to my room. I turned the key easy and stood there until the knob turned. Then she says, "Jason?" "What?" I says. "I just thought something was wrong." "Not in here," I says. "You've come to the wrong place." "I don't mean to worry you," she says. "I'm glad to hear that," I says. "I wasn't sure. I thought I might have been mistaken. Do you want anything?" After a while she says, "No, not anything." Then she went away. I took the box down and counted out the money and hid the box again and unlocked the door and went out. I thought about the camphor, but it would be too late now anyway. And I'd just have one more round trip. She was at her door waiting. "You want anything from town?" I says. "No," she says. "I don't mean to meddle in your affairs, but I don't know what I'd do if anything happened to you, Jason." "I'm all right," I says. "Just a headache." "I wish you'd take some aspirin," she says. "I know you're not going to stop using the car." "What's the car got to do with it?" I says. "How can a car give a man a headache?" "You know gasoline always made you sick," she says, "ever since you were a child. I wish you'd take some aspirin." "Keep on wishing it," I says. "It won't hurt you." I got in the car and started back to town. I just turned onto the street when I saw a Ford come helling toward me. All of a sudden it stopped. I could hear the wheels sliding, and it slewed around and backed and whirled. And just as I was thinking what the hell they were up to, I saw that red tie. Then I recognized her face looking back through the window. It whirled into the alley. I saw it turn again, but when I got to the back street, it was just disappearing, running like hell. I saw red. When I recognized that red tie, after all I had told her, I forgot about everything. I never thought about my head even until I came to the first forks and had to stop. Yet we spend money and spend money on roads, and damn if it isn't like trying to drive over a sheet of corrugated iron roofing. I'd like to know how a man could be expected to keep up with even a wheelbarrow. I think too much of my car. I'm not going to hammer it to pieces like it was a Ford. Chances were they had stolen it anyway, so why should they give a damn? Like I say, blood always tells. If you've got blood like that in you, you'll do anything. I says whatever claim you believe she has on you has already been discharged. I says, from now on, you have only yourself to blame, because you know what any sensible person would do. I says, if I've got to spend half my time being a damn detective, at least I'll go where I can get paid for it. So I had to stop there at the forks. Then I remembered it. It felt like somebody was inside with a hammer beating on it. I says, I've tried to keep you from being worried by her. I says, far as I'm concerned, let her go to hell as fast as she pleases, and the sooner the better. I says, what else do you expect, except every damn drummer and cheap show that comes to town, because even these town jelly beans give her the go-by now. You don't know what goes on, I says. You don't hear the talk that I hear, and you can just bet I shut them up, too. I says, my people owned slaves here. When you were all running little shirt-tail country stores and farming land, no nigger would look at on shares. If they ever farmed it. It's a good thing the Lord did something for this country. The folks that live on it never have. Friday afternoon, and from right here I could see 3 miles of land that hadn't even been broken, and every able-bodied man in the county and town at that show. I might have been a stranger starving to death, and there wasn't a soul in sight to ask which way to town, even. And she trying to get me to take aspirin. I says, when I eat bread, I'll do it at the table. I says, you always talking about how much you give up for us when you could buy 10 new dresses a year on the money you spend for those damn patent medicines. It's not something to cure it I need, it's just an even break. not to have to have them. But as long as I have to work 10 hours a day to support a kitchen full of niggers in the style they're accustomed to and send them to the show where every other nigger in the county, only he was late already. By the time he got there, it'd be over. After a while, he got up to the car, and when I finally got it through his head of two people in a fold had passed him, he said yes. So I went on, and when I came to where the wagon road turned off, I could see the tire tracks. Abe Russell was in his lot, but I didn't bother to ask him, and I hadn't got out of sight of his barn hardly when I saw the fold. They had tried to hide it. Done about as well at it as she did at everything else she did. Like I say, it's not that I object to so much. Maybe she can't help that. It's because she hasn't even got enough consideration for her own family to have any discretion. I'm afraid all the time I'll run into them right in the middle of the street or under a wagon on the square like a couple of dogs. I parked and got out, and now I'd have to go way around and cross a plowed field, the only one I'd seen since I left town, with every step like somebody was walking along behind me hit me on the head with a club. I kept thinking that when I got across the field, at least I'd have something level to walk on that wouldn't jolt me every step, but when I got into the woods it was full of underbrush and I had to twist around through it. And then I came to a ditch full of briars. I went along it for a while, but it got thicker and thicker, and all the time Earl probably telephoning home about where I was and getting Mother all upset again. When I finally got through, I'd had to wind around so much that I had to stop and figure out just where the car would be. I knew they wouldn't be far from it, just under the closest bush, so I turned and worked back toward the road. Then I couldn't tell just how far I was, so I'd have to stop and listen, and then with my legs not using so much blood, it would all go into my head like I would explode any minute, and then the sun getting down to just where it could shine straight into my eyes and my ears ringing so I couldn't hear anything. I went on, trying to move quiet. Then I heard a dog or something, and I knew that when he scented me, he'd have to come helling up, then it would be all off. I'd gotten beggar lice and twigs and stuff all over me, inside my clothes and shoes and all. And then I happened to look around, and I had my hand right on a bunch of poison oak. The only thing I couldn't understand was why it was just poison oak and not a snake or something. So I didn't even bother to move it. I just stood there until the dog went away. Then I went on. I didn't have any idea where the car was now. I couldn't think about anything except my head. And I'd just stand in one place and sort of wonder if I'd really seen a ford even, and I didn't even care much whether I had or not. Like I say, let her lay out all day and all night with everything in town that wears pants. What do I care? I don't owe anything to anybody that has no more consideration for me that wouldn't be a damn bit above planting that ford there and making me spend a whole afternoon and Earl taking her back there and showing her the books just because he's too damn virtuous for this world. I says, you'll have one hell of a time in heaven without anybody's business to meddle in. Only don't you ever let me catch you at it, I says. I close my eyes to it because of your grandmother. But just you let me catch you doing it one time on this place where my mother lives. These damn little slick-head squirts, thinking they're raising so much hell, I'll show them something about hell, I says, and you too. I'll make him think that damn red tie's the latch string to hell if he thinks he can run the woods with my niece. With the sun and all in my eyes and my blood going so, I kept thinking every time my head would go on and burst and get it over with. With briars and things grabbing at me. Then I came onto the sand ditch where they had been, and I recognized the tree where the car was, and just as I got out of the ditch and started running, I heard the car start. It went off fast, blowing the horn. They kept on blowing it, like it was saying, yeah, 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 going out of sight. I got to the road just in time to see it go out of sight. By the time I got up to where my car was, they were clean out of sight, the horn still blowing. Well, I never thought anything about it, except I was saying run, run back to town, run home and try to convince Mother that I never saw you in that car. Try to make her believe that I don't know who he was. Try to make her believe that I didn't miss 10 feet of catching you in that ditch. Try to make her believe you were standing up, too. It kept on saying, yeah, 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 getting fainter and fainter. Then it quit, and I could hear a cow lowing up at Russell's barn. And still I never thought. I went up to the door and opened it and raised my foot. I kind of thought then that the car was leaning a little more than the slant of the road would be, but I never found it out until I got in and started off. Well, I just sat there. It was getting on towards sundown, and town was about 5 miles. They never even had guts enough to puncture it, to jab a hole in it. They just let the air out. I just stood there for a while, thinking about that kitchen full of niggers, and not one of them had time to lift a tire onto the rack and screw up a couple of bolts. It was kind of funny because even she couldn't have seen far enough ahead to take the pump out on purpose, unless she thought about it while he was letting out the air, maybe. But what it probably was somebody took it out and gave it to Ben to play with for a squirt gun, because they'd take the whole car to pieces if he wanted it. And Dilsey says, "Ain't nobody touched your car. What do we want fool with hit fur?" And I says, "You're a nigger. You're lucky, do you know it?" I says, "I'll swap with you any day because it takes a white man not to have any more sense than to worry about what a little slut of a girl does." I walked up to Russell's. He had a pump. That was just an oversight on their part, I reckon. Only I still couldn't believe she'd have had the nerve to. I kept thinking that. I don't know why it is I can't seem to learn that a woman'll do anything. I kept thinking, "Let's forget for a while how I feel toward you and how you feel toward me. I just wouldn't do you this way. I wouldn't do you this way no matter what you'd done to me. Because like I say, blood is blood and you can't get around it. It's not playing a joke that any 8-year-old boy could have thought of. It's letting your own uncle be laughed at by a man that would wear a red tie. They come into town and call us all a bunch of hicks and think it's too small to hold them. Well, he doesn't know just how right he is. And her, too. If that's the way she feels about it, she better keep right on going and a damn good riddance." I stopped and returned Russell's pump and drove on to town. I went to the drugstore and got a shot, and then I went on to the telegraph office. It had closed at 20.21, 40 points down. 40 times $5. Buy something with that if you can, and she'll say, "I've got to have it, I've just got to." And I'll say, "That's too bad. You'll have to try somebody else. I haven't got any money. I've been too busy to make any." I just looked at him. "I'll tell you some news," I says. "You'll be astonished to learn that I am interested in the cotton market," I says. "That never occurred to you, did it?" "I did my best to deliver it," he says. "I tried the store twice and called up your house, but they didn't know where you were," he says, digging in the drawer. "Deliver what?" I says. He handed me a telegram. "What time did this come?" I says. "About 3:30, he says. "And now it's 5:10, I says. "I tried to deliver it," he says. "I couldn't find you." "That's not my fault, is it?" I says. I opened it, just to see what kind of a lie they'd tell me this time. They must be in one hell of a shape if they've got to come all the way to Mississippi to steal $10 a month. "Sell," it says. "The market will be unstable with a general downward tendency. Do not be alarmed following government report." "How much would a message like this cost?" I says. He told me. "They paid it," he says. "Then I owe them that much," I says. "I already knew this." "Send this collect," I says, taking a blank. "Buy," I wrote. "Market just on point of blowing its head off. Occasional flurries for purpose of hooking a few more country suckers who haven't got into the telegraph office yet. Do not be alarmed." "Send that collect," I says. He looked at the message, then he looked at the clock. "Market closed an hour ago," he says. "Well," I says, "that's not my fault either. I didn't invent it. I just bought a little of it while under the impression that the telegraph company would keep me informed as to what it was doing." "A report is posted whenever it comes in," he says. "Yes," I says, "and in Memphis they have it on a blackboard every 10 seconds, I says. "I was within 67 miles of there once this afternoon." He looked at the message. "You want to send this?" he says. "I still haven't changed my mind," I says. I wrote the other one out and counted the money. "And this one, too, if you're sure you can spell B-U-Y." I went back to the store. I could hear the band from down the street. Prohibition's a fine thing. Used to be they'd come in Saturday with just one pair of shoes in the family and him wearing them. And they'd go down to the express office and get his package. Now they all go to the show barefooted, with the merchants in the door like a row of tigers or something in a cage watching them pass. Earl says, "I hope it wasn't anything serious." "What?" I says. He looked at his watch. Then he went to the door and looked at the courthouse clock. "You ought to have a dollar watch," I says. "It won't cost you so much to believe it's lying each time." "What?" he says. "Nothing," I says. "Hope I haven't inconvenienced you." "We were not busy much," he says. "They all went to the show. It's all right." "If it's not all right," I says, "you know what you can do about it." "I said it was all right," he says. "I heard you," I says. "And if it's not all right, you know what you can do about it." "Do you want to quit?" he says. "It's not my business," I says. "My wishes don't matter. But don't get the idea that you are protecting me by keeping me." "You'd be a good businessman if you'd let yourself, Jason," he says. "At least I can tend to my own business and let other people's alone," I says. "I don't know why you are trying to make me fire you," he says. "You know you could quit any time and there wouldn't be any hard feelings between us." "Maybe that's why I don't quit," I says. "As long as I tend to my job, that's what you are paying me for." I went on to the back and got a drink of water and went on out to the back door. Job had the cultivators all set up at last. It was quiet there, and pretty soon my head got a little easier. I could hear them singing now, and then the band played again. Well, let them get every quarter and dime in the county. It was no skin off my back. I've done what I could. A man that can live as long as I have and not know when to quit is a fool, especially as it's no business of mine. If it was my own daughter now, it would be different, because she wouldn't have time to. She'd have to work some to feed a few invalids and idiots and niggers, because how could I have the face to bring anybody there? I've too much respect for anybody to do that. I'm a man, I can stand it. It's my own flesh and blood, and I'd like to see the color of the man's eyes that would speak disrespectful of any woman that was my friend. It's these damn good women that do it. I'd like to see the good church-going woman that's half as square as Lorraine, whore or no whore. Like I say, if I was to get married, you'd go up like a balloon, and you know it. And she says, I want you to be happy, to have a family of your own, not to slave your life away for us. But I'll be gone soon, and then you can take a wife, but you'll never find a woman who is worthy of you. And I says, yes, I could. You'd get right up out of your grave, you know you would. I says, no, thank you, I have all the women I can take care of now. If I married a wife, she'd probably turn out to be a hophead or something. That's all we lack in this family, I says. The sun was down beyond the Methodist church now, and the pigeons were flying back and forth around the steeple, and when the band stopped, I could hear them cooing. It hadn't been 4 months since Christmas, and yet they were almost as thick as ever. I reckon Parson Waldorf was getting a belly full of them now. You'd have thought we were shooting people, with him making speeches and even holding on to a man's gun when they came over. Talking about peace on earth, goodwill toward all, and not a sparrow can fall to earth. But what does he care how thick they get? He hasn't got anything to do. What does he care what time it is? He pays no taxes. He doesn't have to see his money gone every year to have the courthouse clock cleaned to where it'll run. They had to pay a man $45 to clean it. I counted over 100 half-hatched pigeons on the ground. You'd think they'd have sense enough to leave town. It's a good thing I don't have any more ties than a pigeon, I'll say that. The band was playing again, a loud, fast tune, like they were breaking up. I reckon they'd be satisfied now. Maybe they'd have enough music to entertain them while they drove 14 or 15 miles home and unharnessed in the dark and fed the stock and milked. All they'd have to do would be to whistle the music and tell the jokes to the livestock in the barn, and then they could count up how much they'd made by not taking the stock to the show, too. They could figure that if a man had 5 children and 7 mules, he cleared a quarter by taking his family to the show. Just like that. Earl came back with a couple of packages. "Here's some more stuff going out," he says. "Where's Uncle Job?" "Gone to the show, I imagine," I says, "unless you watched him." "He doesn't slip off," he says. "I can depend on him." "Meaning me by that," I says. He went to the door and looked out, listening. "That's a good band," he says. "It's about time they were breaking up, I'd say." "Unless they're going to spend the night there," I says. The swallows had begun, and I could hear the sparrows beginning to swarm in the trees in the courthouse yard. Every once in a while a bunch of them would come swirling around inside above the roof, then go away. They are as big a nuisance as the pigeons, to my notion. You can't even sit in the courthouse yard for them. First thing you know, bing, right on your hat. But it would take a millionaire to afford to shoot them at 5 cents a shot. If they just put a little poison out there in the square, they'd get rid of them in a day, because if a merchant can't keep his stock from running around the square, he'd better try to deal in something besides chickens, something that don't eat, like plows or onions. And if a man don't keep his dogs up, he either don't want it or he hasn't any business with one. Like I say, if all the businesses in town are run like country businesses, you're going to have a country town. It won't do you any good if they have broke up, I says. They'll have to hitch up and take out to get home by midnight as it is. Well, he says, they enjoy it. Let them spend a little money on a show now and then. The hill farmer works pretty hard and gets mighty little for it. There's no law making them farm in the hills, I says, or anywhere else. Where would you and me be if it wasn't for the farmers, he says. I'd be home right now, I says, lying down with an ice pack on my head. You have these headaches too often, he says. Why don't you have your teeth examined good? Did he go over them all this morning? Did who? I says. You said you went to the dentist this morning. Do you object to my having the headache on your time? I says. Is that it? They were crossing the alley now, coming up from the show. There they come, he says. I reckon I better get up front. He went on. It's a curious thing how, no matter what's wrong with you, a man'll tell you to have your teeth examined, and a woman'll tell you to get married. It always takes a man that never made much at anything to tell you how to run your business, though. Like these college professors without a whole pair of socks to his name, telling you how to make a million in 10 years. And a woman that couldn't even get a husband can always tell you how to raise a family. Old man Job came up with the wagon. After a while, he got through wrapping the lines around the whip socket. Well, I says, was it a good show? I ain't been yet, he says, but I can be arrested in that tent tonight, though. Like hell you haven't, I says. You've been away from here since 3 o'clock. Mr. Earle was just back here looking for you. I've been tending to my business, he says. Mr. Earle knows where I've been. You make him fool him, I says. I won't tell on you. Then he's the onliest man here I'd try to fool, he says. Well, I won't waste my time fooling a man what I don't care whether I sees him Saturday night or not. I won't try to fool you, he says. You too smart for me. Yes, sir, he says, looking busy as hell, putting 5 or 6 little packages into the wagon. You's too smart for me. Ain't a man in this town can keep up with you for smartness. You fools a man what's so smart he can't even keep up with hisself, he says, getting in the wagon and unwrapping the reins. Who's that? I says. That's Mr. Jason Compson, he says. Get up there, Dan. One of the wheels was just about to come off. I watched to see if he'd get out of the alley before it did. Just turn any vehicle over to a nigger, though. I says that old rattle-trap's just an eyesore, yet you keep it standing there in the carriage house 100 years just so that boy can ride to the cemetery once a week. I says he's not the first fellow that'll have to do things he doesn't want to do. I'd make him ride in that car like a civilized man or stay at home. What does he know about where he goes or what he goes in, and us keeping a carriage and a horse so he can take a ride on Sunday afternoon? A lot Job cared whether the wheel came off or not, long as he wouldn't have too far to walk back. Like I say, the only place for them is in the field, where they'd have to work from sunup to sundown. They can't stand prosperity or an easy job. Let one stay around white people for a while, and he's not worth killing. They get so they can outguess you about work before your very eyes, like Roscus. The only mistake he ever made was he got careless one day and died. Shirking and stealing, and giving you a little more lip and a little more lip until some day you have to lay them out with a scantling or something. Well, it's Earl's business, but I'd hate to have my business advertised over this town by an old doddering nigger and a wagon that you thought every time I turned a corner it would come all to pieces. The sun was all high up in the air now, and inside it was beginning to get dark. I went up front. The square was empty. Earl was back closing the safe, and then the clock begun to strike. "You locked the back door?" he says. I went back and locked it and came back. "I suppose you're going to the show tonight," he says. "I gave you those passes yesterday, didn't I?" "Yes," I says. "You want them back?" "No, no," he says. "I just forgot whether I gave them to you or not. No sense in wasting them." He locked the door and said good night and went on. The sparrows were still rattling away in the trees, but the square was empty except for a few cars. There was a Ford in front of the drugstore, but I didn't even look at it. I know when I've had enough of anything. I don't mind trying to help her, but I know when I've had enough. I guess I could teach Luster to drive it, then they could chase her all day long if they wanted to, and I could stay home and play with Ben. I went in and got a couple of cigars. Then I thought I'd have another headache shot for luck, and I stood and talked with them for a while. "Well," Mac says, "I reckon you've got your money on the Yankees this year." "What for?" I says. "The pennant," he says. "Not anything in the league can beat them." "Like hell there's not," I says. "They're shot," I says. "You think a team can be that lucky forever?" "I don't call it luck," Mac says. "I wouldn't bet on any team that fellow Ruth played on," I says, "even if I knew it was going to win." "Yes," Mac says. "I can name you a dozen men in either league who are more valuable than he is," I says. "What have you got against Ruth?" Mac says. "Nothing," I says. "I haven't got anything against him. I don't even like to look at his picture." I went on out. The lights were coming on, and people going along the streets toward home. Sometimes the sparrows never got still until full dark. The night they turned on the new lights around the courthouse, it waked them up, and they were flying around and blundering into the lights all night long. They kept it up two or three nights, then one morning they were all gone. Then, after about 2 months, they all came back again. I drove on home. There were no lights in the house yet, but they'd all be looking out the windows, and Dilsey jawing away in the kitchen like it was her own food she was having to keep hot until I got there. You'd think to hear her that there wasn't but one supper in the world, and that was the one she had to keep back a few minutes on my account. Well, at least I could come home one time without finding Ben and that nigger hanging on the gate like a bear and a monkey in the same cage. Just let it come toward sundown, and he'd head for the gate like a cow for the barn, hanging onto it and bobbing his head and sort of moaning to himself. That's a hog for punishment for you. If what had happened to him for fooling with open gates had happened to me, I never would want to see another one. I often wondered what he'd be thinking about down there at the gate, watching the girls going home from school, trying to want something he couldn't even remember he didn't and couldn't want any longer, and what he'd think when they'd be undressing him and he'd happen to take a look at himself and begin to cry like he'd do. But like I say, they never did enough of that. I says, "I know what you need. You need what they did to Ben, then you'd behave. And if you don't know what that was," I says, "ask Dilsey to tell you." There was a light in Mother's room. I put the car up and went on into the kitchen. Luster and Ben were there. "Where's Dilsey?" I says, "putting supper on?" "She upstairs with Miss Caroline," Luster says. "They been going it, ever since Miss Quinton come home. Mammy up there keeping 'em from fighting." "Is that show come, Mr. Jason?" "Yes," I says. "I thought I heard the band," he says. "Wish I could go," he says. "I could if I just had a quarter." Dilsey came in. "You come, is you?" she says. "What you been up to this evening? You knows how much work I got to do. Why don't you get here on time?" "Maybe I went to the show," I says. "Is supper ready?" "Wish I could go," Luster says. "I could if I just had a quarter." "You ain't got no business at no show," Dilsey says. "You go on in the house and sit down," she says. "Don't you go upstairs and get 'em started again now." "What's the matter?" I says. "Quentin come in a while ago and says you've been following her around all evening, and then Miss Caroline jumped on her. Why don't you let her alone? Can't you live in the same house with your own blood niece without quarreling?" "I can't quarrel with her," I says, "because I haven't seen her since this morning. What does she say I've done now, made her go to school? That's pretty bad," I says. "Well, you tend to your business and let her alone," Dilsey says. "I'll take care of her, if you and Miss Caroline will let me. Go on in, darn, now, and behave yourself till I get supper on." "If I just had a quarter," Luster says, "I could go to that show." "And if you had wings, you could fly to heaven," Dilsey says. "I don't want to hear another word about that show." "That reminds me," I says, "I got a couple of tickets they gave me." I took them out of my coat. "You fixin' to use 'em?" Luster says. "Not me," I says. "I wouldn't go to it for $10. "Give me one of 'em, Mr. Jason," he says. "I'll sell you one," I says. "How about it?" "I ain't got no money," he says. "That's too bad," I says. I made to go out. "Give me one of 'em, Mr. Jason," he says. "You ain't gwine need 'em both." "Hush your mouth," Dilsey says. "Don't you know he ain't gwine give nothing away?" "How much you want for it?" he says. "$0.05," I says. "I ain't got that much," he says. "How much you got?" I says. "I ain't got nothing," he says. "All right," I says. I went on. "Mr. Jason," he says. "Won't you hush up," Dilsey says. "He just teasing you. He fixin' to use them tickets hisself. Go on, Jason, and let him alone." "I don't want them," I says. I came back to the stove. "I came in here to burn them up. but if you want to buy one for a nickel, I says, looking at him and opening the stove lid. I ain't got that much, he says. All right, I says. I dropped one of them in the stove. You, Jason, Dilsey says, ain't you shamed? Mr. Jason, he says, please, sir, I'll fix them tires every day for a month. I need the cash, I says. You can have it for a nickel. Hush, Luster, Dilsey says. She jerked him back. Go on, she says, drop it in, go on, get it over with. You can have it for a nickel, I says. Go on, Dilsey says, he ain't got no nickel, go on, drop it in. All right, I says. I dropped it in and Dilsey shut the stove. A big growed man like you, she says, get on out my kitchen. Hush, she says to Luster, don't you get Benji started. I'll get you a quarter from Phony tonight, and you can go tomorrow night. Hush up now. I went on into the living room. I couldn't hear anything from upstairs. I opened the paper. After a while, Ben and Luster came in. Ben went to the dark place on the wall where the mirror used to be, rubbing his hands on it and slobbering and moaning. Luster begun punching at the fire. What are you doing? I says. We don't need any fire tonight. I'm trying to keep him quiet, he says. He'd always cold Easter, he says. Only this is not Easter, I says. Let it alone. He put the poker back and got the cushion out of Mother's chair and gave it to Ben, and he hunkered down in front of the fireplace and got quiet. I read the paper. There hadn't been a sound from upstairs when Dilsey came in and sent Ben and Luster on to the kitchen and said supper was ready. All right, I says. She went out. I sat there, reading the paper. After a while, I heard Dilsey looking in at the door. Why don't you come on and eat, she says. I'm waiting for supper, I says. It's on the table, she says. I done told you. Is it? I says. Excuse me, I didn't hear anybody come down. They ain't coming, she says. You come on and eat so I can take something up to them. Are they sick? I says. What did the doctor say it was? Not smallpox, I hope. Come on here, Jason, she says, so I can get done. All right, I says, raising the paper again. I'm waiting for supper now. I could feel her watching me at the door. I read the paper. What you want to act like this for, she says, when you knows how much bother I has anyway. If mother's any sicker than she was when she came down to dinner, all right, I says. But as long as I am buying food for people younger than I am, they'll have to come down to the table to eat it. Let me know when supper's ready, I says, reading the paper again. I heard her climbing the stairs, dragging her feet and grunting and groaning like they were straight up and 3 feet apart. I heard her at mother's door, then I heard her calling Quentin, like the door was locked. Then she went back to mother's room, and then mother went and talked to Quentin. Then they came downstairs. I read the paper. Dilsey came back to the door. Come on, she says, for you can think up some old devilment. You just trying yourself tonight. I went to the dining room. Quentin was sitting with her head bent. She had painted her face again. Her nose looked like a porcelain insulator. I'm glad you feel well enough to come down, I says to Mother. It's little enough I can do for you to come to the table, she says, no matter how I feel. I realize that when a man works all day, he likes to be surrounded by his family at the supper table. I want to please you. I only wish you and Quentin got along better. It would be easier for me. We get along all right, I says. I don't mind her staying locked up in her room all day if she wants to, but I can't have all this whoop-de-doo and sulking at meal times. I know that's a lot to ask her, but I'm that way in my own house. Your house, I meant to say. It's yours, Mother says. You are the head of it now. Quentin hadn't looked up. I helped the plates, and she begun to eat. Did you get a good piece of meat? I says. If you didn't, I'll try to find you a better one. She didn't say anything. I say, did you get a good piece of meat? I says. What? She says, yes, it's all right. Will you have some more rice? I says. No, she says. Better let me give you some more, I says. I don't want any more, she says. Not at all, I says. You're welcome. Is your headache gone? Mother says. Headache, I says. I was afraid you were developing one, she says, when you came in this afternoon. Oh, I says, no, it didn't show up. We stayed so busy this afternoon, I forgot about it. Was that why you were late? Mother says. I could see Quentin listening. I looked at her. Her knife and fork were still going, but I caught her looking at me. Then she looked at her plate again. I says, "No, I loaned my car to a fellow about 3 o'clock, and I had to wait until he got back with it." I eat for a while.
"Who was it?"
Mother says. "It was one of those show men," I says. "It seems his sister's husband was out riding with some town woman, and he was chasing them." Quentin sat perfectly still, chewing.
"You ought not to lend your car to people like that," Mother says. "You are too generous with it. That's why I never call on you for it if I can help it."
"I was beginning to think that myself for a while," I says, "but he got back all right. He says he found what he was looking for."
"Who was the woman?"
Mother says. "I'll tell you later," I says. "I don't like to talk about such things before Quentin." Quentin had quit eating. Every once in a while she'd take a drink of water, then she'd sit there crumbling a biscuit up, her face bent over her plate.
"Yes," Mother says. "I suppose women who stay shut up like I do have no idea what goes on in this town."
"Yes," I says, "they don't."
"My life has been so different from that,"
Mother says.
"Thank God I don't know about such wickedness. I don't even want to know about it. I'm not like most people."
I didn't say any more. Quentin sat there, crumbling the biscuit until I quit eating. Then she says,
"Can I go now?"
without looking at anybody.
"What?"
I says. "Sure you can go. Were you waiting on us?" She looked at me. She had crumpled all the bread, but her hands still went on like they were crumpling it yet, and her eyes looked like they were cornered or something. And then she started biting her mouth like it ought to have poisoned her with all that red lead.
"Grandmother," she says. "Grandmother."
"Did you want something else to eat?" I says.
"Why does he treat me like this, grandmother?" she says. "I never hurt him."
"I want you all to get along with one another," Mother says. "You are all that's left now, and I do want you all to get along better."
"It's his fault," she says. "He won't let me alone, and I have to. If he doesn't want me here, why won't he let me go back to—"
"That's enough," I says. "Not another word."
"Then why won't he let me alone?" she says. "He is the nearest thing to a father you've ever had,"
Mother says.
"It's his bread you and I eat. It's only right that he should expect obedience from you." "It's his fault," she says.
She jumped up.
"He makes me do it. If he would just—"
She looked at us, her eyes cornered, kind of jerking her arms against her sides.
"If I would just what?" I says. "Whatever I do, it's your fault," she says. "If I'm bad, it's because I had to be. You made me. I wish I was dead. I wish we were all dead."
Then she ran. We heard her run up the stairs. Then a door slammed. "That's the first sensible thing she ever said," I says.
"She didn't go to school today," Mother says.
"How do you know?" I says. "Were you downtown?"
"I just know," she says. "I wish you could be kinder to her."
"If I did that, I'd have to arrange to see her more than once a day," I says. "You'll have to make her come to the table every meal. Then I could give her an extra piece of meat every time."
"There are little things you could do," she says.
"Like not paying any attention when you ask me to see that she goes to school?" I says.
"She didn't go to school today," she says. "I just know she didn't. She says she went for a car ride with one of the boys this afternoon, and you followed her."
"How could I?" I says, "when somebody had my car all afternoon." "Whether or not she was in school today is already past," I says. "If you've got to worry about it, worry about next Monday."
"I wanted you and she to get along with one another," she says. "But she has inherited all of the headstrong traits. Quentin's, too. I thought at the time, with the heritage she would already have, to give her that name, too. Sometimes I think she is the judgment of both of them upon me."
"Good Lord," I says, "you've got a fine mind. No wonder you keep yourself sick all the time."
"What?" she says. "I don't understand."
"I hope not," I says. "A good woman misses a lot. She's better off without knowing."
"They were both that way," she says. "They would make interest with your father against me when I tried to correct them. He was always saying they didn't need controlling, that they already knew what cleanliness and honesty were, which was all that anyone could hope to be taught. And now I hope he's satisfied."
"You've got Ben to depend on," I says. "Cheer up."
"They deliberately shut me out of their lives," she says. "It was always her and Quentin. They were always conspiring against me. Against you, too, though you were too young to realize it. They always looked on you and me as outsiders, like they did your Uncle Maury. I always told your father that they were allowed too much freedom, to be together too much. When Quentin started to school, we had to let her go the next year so she could be with him. She couldn't bear for any of you to do anything she couldn't. It was vanity in her, vanity and false pride. And then when her troubles began, I knew that Quentin would feel that he had to do something just as bad. But I didn't believe that he would have been so selfish as to. I didn't dream that he—" "Maybe he knew it was going to be a girl," I says, "and that one more of them would be more than he could stand." "He could have controlled her," she says. "He seemed to be the only person she had any consideration for. But that is part of the judgment, too, I suppose." "Yes," I says, "too bad it wasn't me instead of him. You'd be a lot better off." "You say things like that to hurt me," she says. "I deserve it, though. When they began to sell the land to send Quentin to Harvard, I told your father that he must make an equal provision for you. Then when Herbert offered to take you into the bank, I said, 'Jason is provided for now.' And when all the expense began to pile up and I was forced to sell our furniture and the rest of the pasture, I wrote her at once because I said she will realize that she and Quentin have had their share and part of Jason's too, and that it depends on her now to compensate him. I said she will do that out of respect for her father. I believed that then, but I'm just a poor old woman. I was raised to believe that people would deny themselves for their own flesh and blood. It's my fault. You were right to reproach me. Do you think I need any man's help to stand on my feet?' I says, 'let alone a woman that can't name the father of her own child.' 'Jason,' she says. 'All right,' I says. 'I didn't mean that, of course not. If I believed that were possible, after all my suffering—' 'Of course it's not,' I says. 'I didn't mean it.' 'I hope that at least is spared me,' she says. 'Sure it is,' I says. 'She's too much like both of them to doubt that.' 'I couldn't bear that,' she says. 'Then quit thinking about it,' I says. 'Has she been worrying you any more about getting out at night?' 'No. I made her realize that it was for her own good, and that she'd thank me for it some day. She takes her books with her and studies after I lock the door. I see the light on as late as 11 o'clock some nights.' 'How do you know she's studying?' I says. 'I don't know what else she'd do in there alone,' she says. 'She never did read any.' 'No,' I says, 'you wouldn't know, and you can thank your stars for that,' I says. 'Only what would be the use in saying it aloud? It would just have her crying on me again.' I heard her go upstairs. Then she called Quentin, and Quentin says, 'What?' through the door. 'Good night,' Mother says. Then I heard the key in the lock, and Mother went back to her room. When I finished my cigar and went up, the light was still on. I could see the empty keyhole, but I couldn't hear a sound. She studied quiet. Maybe she learned that in school. I told Mother good night and went on to my room and got the box out and counted it again. I could hear the Great American Gelding snoring away like a planing mill. I read somewhere they'd fix men that way to give them women's voices. But maybe he didn't know what they'd done to him. I don't reckon he even knew what he had been trying to do, or why Mr. Burgess knocked him out with the fence picket. And if they'd just sent him on to Jackson while he was under the ether, he'd never have known the difference. But that would have been too simple for a Compson to think of. Not half complex enough. Having to wait to do it all until he broke out and tried to run a little girl down on the street with her own father looking at him. Well, like I say, they never started soon enough with their cutting, and they quit too quick. I know at least two more that needed something like that, and one of them not over a mile away, either. But then I don't reckon even that would do any good. Like I say, once a bitch, always a bitch. And just let me have 24 hours without any damn New York Jew to advise me what it's going to do. I don't want to make a killing. Save that to suck in the smart gamblers with. I just want an even chance to get my money back. And once I've done that, they can bring all Beale Street and all Bedlam in here, and two of them can sleep in my bed, and another one can have my place at the table, too."